Let's turn to some expert context. Paul Bigman is going to present it to us on behalf, who's the ILWU, the Longshore Workers Organizer. And she's going to present it on behalf of Tracy Lai, who has the flu.
Thank you, Margaret. I feel a little odd as a union organizer being up here providing expert testimony, but let me begin by saying I've been a union organizer full-time for 20 years with the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union, the Retail Wholesale Department Store Union, the United Electrical Radio Machine Workers of America, the Communications Workers of America, and for the past 6 years with the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. I'm also the treasurer of Washington State Jobs with Justice and co-chair of the Labor Party Seattle chapter. So although I don't have the academic credentials which Professor Lai has, I've been laboring in the vineyards for a while. The first known strike in U.S. history came in 1663, a little earlier than most people think of it, when six indentured servants in Maryland struck because their master hadn't given them enough to eat. They cried, "We desire but so much as is sufficient, but he will allow us nothing but beans and bread," for which they were found guilty of criminal conspiracy and given 30 lashes each. In the eyes of many in the labor movement in the early 20th century, federal protection for labor rights began long before the National Labor Relations Act. It began with the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, barring slavery or involuntary servitude. In 1911, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the purpose of the 13th Amendment was not simply to eliminate slavery, but also, and I'm quoting from the Supreme Court here, to make labor free, by prohibiting that control by which the personal service of one man is disposed of or coerced for another's benefit. Samuel Gompers, the rather conservative head of the American Federation of Labor, shared this view. In 1932, Congress passed the Norris-LaGuardia Act, finding that while a worker, quote, should be free to decline to associate with his fellows, it is necessary that he have full freedom of association, self-organization, and designation of representatives of his own choosing to negotiate the terms and conditions of his employment, and that he should be free from the interference or coercion of employers of labor or their agents in the designation of such representatives or in self-organization or in other concerted activities for the purpose of collective bargaining or other mutual aid or protection. In short, that workers should have the right to make decisions for themselves without fear of oppression or retaliation or termination by their employers. Senator Norris, the chief sponsor, viewed the act as an extension of the 13th Amendment, arguing that anti-strike injunctions brought about, quote, slavery and involuntary servitude on the part of those who must toil in order that they and their families may live. The next year, Congress enacted the National Industrial Recovery Act, for the first time guaranteeing workers a remedy when employers discriminated against union supporters or forced them to join company unions. Unfortunately, although the act empowered the federal government to enforce those provisions, President Roosevelt left enforcement to the workers affected, taking actions on their own. In 1934, the nation was rocked by massive strikes. Longshore, my own union, on the West Coast, truckers in Minneapolis, automobile workers in Toledo, textile workers throughout the South. The following year, we became very close to having national strikes in auto and rubber, and the Supreme Court struck down the National Industrial Recovery Act as unconstitutional, leading, as anyone who remembers history, to efforts to pack the court. The government could see the likelihood of increasing worker unrest. Reacting to this, Congress passed the Wagner Act, or the National Labor Relations Act. It not only guaranteed the right to self-organization, to form or to join unions, and to bargain collectively, but also prohibited employers from interfering with these rights. While Wagner charged that non-union workplaces resembled slavery, he rejected pleas from labor leaders to ground his bill on Congress's right to enforce the 13th Amendment. Instead, he argued that his bill would not only eliminate industrial slavery, but would also bring about industrial peace, facilitating the free flow of interstate commerce. And that's where we started having problems. Because instead of passing a law which everyone agreed was there to protect the rights of workers to organize and to collectively bargain, it turned into a law to protect the free flow of commerce. And it was based, instead of on the 13th Amendment, on the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution. And the result was that government lawyers ended up defending the new law as an exercise of Congress's right to control and punish strikes instead of, as it was originally intended, a law to protect the right to strike. The result was a court ruling which, as anyone familiar with what happens with air traffic controllers know, gave employers the right to hire permanent scabs with a property right to carry on their business. Now, why did all this occur? The economic and social pressures that came with the Great Depression resulted in a massive upsurge in worker unrest. Congress responded with a safety valve. A safety valve is not a bad thing. It's a step forward. But after World War II, when unions freed from the constraints of supporting the war effort, unleashed a wave of strikes in coal, auto, electric, rail, oil, steel, meatpacking, winning massive 18.5-cent-an-hour raises, labor's enemies struck back. Exploiting anti-communist hysteria to attack the labor movement, Congress passed Taft-Hartley. Congress heard the plaintive whimpering of General Electric, General Motors, and U.S. Steel, and when they said, "But it's not fair. We need to be protected against the workers. It isn't enough to protect the workers against the largest and most powerful corporations in the world. We need something more even-handed along the lines of the apocryphal laws in Paris, which prohibit both the rich and the poor from sleeping under the bridges." For the first time, Congress established so-called unfair labor practices for workers and our unions, as though we had power to harm the corporations, so that employers could actually seek relief from the federal government to aid them in their efforts to deal with worker organizing. Unions and their leaders were required to sign anti-communist affidavits, gutting some of the strongest and most militant unions and pitting unions against one another. And so-called right-to-work laws were permitted, allowing states to outlaw union security clauses under which all workers who benefit from union representation have to share in the cost of that representation. This got even worse in 1959 with the passage of the Landrum-Griffin Act. Under Landrum-Griffin, they outlawed so-called hot cargoing, the right of workers to refuse to deal with struck goods. They put severe restrictions on secondary boycotts, under which labor had the right to go out to a retail store represented by Steve's union and say, "Don't shop here because they are selling struck goods in the store." Landrum-Griffin took away some of our most powerful weapons to defend ourselves. Over time, the National Labor Relations Board, which was initially created to protect workers' rights, came to be seen instead as a neutral arbiter between powerful corporations and individuals trying to organize. It's a long way from the Norales-LaGuardia Act, which found that, and I'm quoting here again, "the individual unorganized worker is commonly helpless to exercise actual liberty of contract and to protect his freedom of labor and thereby to obtain acceptable terms and conditions of employment." Today, when workers try to organize, 92% of employers force employees to attend mandatory anti-union presentations, what we call captive audience meetings. 78% force their workers to attend one-on-one anti-union meetings with managers, which is extremely intimidating, of course, when you're dealing with somebody who has the power to fire you. 3 out of every 4 employers hire union-busting consultants to fight organizing. Just over half threaten to close the plant if the workers organize. In workplaces with immigrant workers, over half of employers faced with an organizing drive threaten to call the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And in 25% of union organizing drives, 1 out of every 4, employers illegally fire at least one worker for union activity. As weak as the National Labor Relations Board has become as a protection for workers, over 10,000 workers each year are reinstated with back pay to their jobs because they've been illegally terminated for union activity. 42 million workers without union representation say they want to join a union, but 1 out of every 18 workers involved in union organizing drives in the private sector faces termination or retaliation. The Dunlap Commission on the Future of Worker Management Relations, and by the way, this was a U.S. government commission from the Departments of Labor and Commerce. The Dunlap Commission reported that for every 48 workers involved in a union election, 1 is fired and gets his or her job back. That is, of course, the tip of the iceberg. These are the ones who can prove to the satisfaction of the National Labor Relations Board that that is why they lost their jobs. And what are the remedies offered for these violations? Generally, if the NLRB finds that an employer has violated workers' rights and violated federal law, the remedy is they have to post a notice in the shop saying they broke the law and they're sorry. It would be an exaggeration to call that a slap on the wrist. It's more like shaking a finger and saying, bad boss, no more donuts. U.S. labor law simply has no teeth. Big business has achieved its goal. A national poll found that 79% of American workers agree that it is very likely or somewhat likely that non-union workers will get fired if they try to organize a union, and about 40% feared that they would be fired themselves if they tried to organize. In this context, the surprise is not the failing rate of unionization, but the courage of those workers like those who will testify here tonight. Thank you.
As you might have noticed, Jose here is going to keep the time, and he's going to be very authoritative about it. And I have a hook. Okay, we're now going to turn to the worker testimony. Each of the workers will have 5 minutes to present their testimony. We'll start with Lloyd Weatherford, who's the organizer for the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. Want to come forward?
Thank you. And, you know, what's at issue here is how broke the system is, and that's why the Carpenters Union has brought an organizer who deals firsthand with the NLRB rather than the workers who are beat up by it, because lots of times they see, like, a more distant effect. But anyways, we are not, and also, you know, you hear people talk about campaigns, and we've got a short video that I gave the panelists so that later on when you have your at your leisure, you can view and see that this was a campaign where we had strong worker support, where, you know, we did everything right, the employer made a fatal error, and if the NLRB worked the way that it was supposed to, we would have won this campaign. And in the end, everyone wound up losing. But anyways, we are not citing the most recent case we have had before the National Labor Relations Board, known as the NLRB, but the one that most clearly illustrates how badly the system is broken. Even though we avoid going to the NLRB, we have had a number of cases before them in recent years. In none of these was justice done. In one case, we had a unanimous election. That is a 100%, almost unheard of in labor elections. We had 100% for the union and in favor of union representation that never resulted in a collective bargaining agreement. The employer basically stalled until everyone lost interest and went away. And and this is supposed to be illegal, but, you know, if something's against the law and there's no consequences, people keep doing it. In another, we had a clear, consistent testimony backed up by meticulously kept daily log given by a wrongfully terminated worker. The employer's testimony was implausible, incredible, and full of contradictions. They found in favor of the employer. In yet another NLRB, in yet another, the NLRB filed an injunction against us, prohibiting us from telling the public the truth about the employer's substandard pay and conditions. We no longer have faith in the NLRB process and instead focus on protecting our area standards. This is not a pretty prospect, but it is the one realistic course of action we have left to further our goal, that is to improve wages and conditions for all carpenters. In December 2000, we had been talking to carpenters employed by Black Knight as part of our efforts to raise standards in the residential construction industry. Residential carpenters tend to migrate from one employer to another depending on who is currently hiring. We had run into many of Black Knight's carpenters before and had built a trusting relationship with them over time. They complained that they were not being paid for all the hours they worked. They worked 60 hours a week without being paid time and a half for overtime. They were exposed to numerous safety hazards, and they were abused by their foreman. They wanted to stand up to improve their conditions. A few leaders emerged, and the crew began to demand fair treatment. The employer fired two of the leaders and suggested that any other troublemakers would get more of the same. Then the crew started having late-night planning meetings with our organizers to fight for better pay and conditions. We organized a huge rally to support the illegally fired workers, and the vast majority of the remaining workers walked off the Belltown job in protest. The next day, workers walked off the rest of Black Knight's projects all across King County. All of these projects were at a virtual standstill. The next day, February 2nd, 2001, a majority of the carpenters who worked for Black Knight in Washington signed a petition for recognition. The NLRB supposedly recognizes this as the equivalent of bargaining cards. That afternoon, Rene DeRosier, the top management official in charge of the operations for Black Knight in the U.S., was handing out paychecks and illegally interrogating and threatening the strikers. At this time, we presented him with the petition and requested that he cease these activities. He accepted the petition and also stated that he had no problem that the Carpenters Union was the workers' representative. At this time, oh crap. At this time, I'll speed it up here. Nope. At this point, the campaign for recognition should have been over and the bargaining for the first contract should have begun. Next, Black Knight hired a lawyer. Black Knight then changed their story. They refused to speak to us and rescinded their recognition of the union. This is supposed to be illegal, according to the NLRB. The board agent said that the employer submitted evidence that we did not have a majority. He would not say what it was or give details, but instead asked us to prove otherwise, even though we had repeatedly asked for details of the evidence we were fighting. Black Knight had half a dozen job sites and transferred workers daily from one job site to the other. This made verbal testimony appear contradictory and unclear. We had been tracking all of this employer's... Okay. Basically, they presented evidence that we could not see, and we were kind of like poking at it, trying to prove this evidence, dispute this evidence, but we never got to see what... There's no other court in America that I know of where you fight evidence you can't see. Eventually, the same evidence... came to hurt us in the with the Department of Labor and Industries, and when we saw it, we could see clearly that they included named perpetrators of the unfair labor practices as members of the bargaining unit. They named a tower crane operator, they named foremen, they named superintendents, and that is how. And because we could not see the list of these names, which if we had seen them, we'd clearly been able to prove that. That we did have a majority, and the relief that I'm seeking, which is kind of the conclusion here, is as a step in the right direction. Excuse me. The conclusion is that as a step in the right direction, we ask public agencies bar employers who have been charged and found by the NLRB to have committed unfair labor practices from working or contracting to any public agencies as long as they have not signed a collective bargaining agreement with their employers. Jurisdictional charges should be accepted because they do not rise to the level of abuse described here today. The real solution is to completely overhaul the NLRB and to repeal and completely rewrite the Taft-Hartley Act. A patch job will not do. In the current political climate, this is not an achievable option at this time. For now, we ask both the panel and the pillars of the community in the audience to understand our efforts and to fight for family wage jobs and take the time to support unions who picket, flyer, and otherwise campaign to improve wages. Make a call to the decision makers and let them know you support the unions involved. And you'll hear reference to the poster.
More
and
questions.
Okay.
I've already made another of many mistakes that I'll make this evening. I was supposed to invite all the witnesses up to this table. So could Jake Rice, Marie Spears, and Rebecca Smith come up? And on your way up, Jake, will you give your testimony? He is a former CWA 78... 100 Shuttle Express driver. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there an editor in the house? I thought I had 10 minutes, so maybe I should just read every other sentence. Yeah, feel free to interrupt with questions. As anyone who knows me will tell you, I feel free to interrupt people anytime I have questions. I didn't want
to...
Oh, really? Okay.
You know, enough with the sad stories, with the evil bosses and the firings of union organizers and the intimidation of union supporters and the threats to spouses in letters, anti-union letters, about how they're going to lose their job and not be able to pay their mortgage. I have a story of a gentleman employer and gentleman owner and managers who believe in democracy and promote it at all times. I may be having a hard time keeping a straight face here, but the point is that 95% of the events between the employer and the union in our campaign were a template, a model of what a new law should look like governing labor management relations and conduct during a first contract effort. A little of the evidence. I went to work for the employer in 1994. Between 1991 and 1994, there were two union efforts by the appropriate union as far as the kind of work we did. They were both abortive attempts. In 1995, two of us found another union that was willing to take it on, and we got card check. We had a good committee to work with us. We got through card check, and we lost the election. The union organizer just kind of disappeared on us, and he wouldn't allow anything but hackneyed leaflets from some campaign that was successful back in the 70s for us to use. So that died. But then in the winter of 1997 and 98, I was convinced to do it again. Four of us were involved in this process, and other people came forward to give their time and take some responsibility during this effort, largely due to the fact that we had a marvelous organizer. And this is one of the things that we learned from the first campaign, was that regardless of what union you should be with, the person who's going to get you where you need to go to get you started, the first step is the organizer. You have to go with a fantastic organizer. We had one with, you know, creative planning, great strategy, a lot of enthusiasm and energy, and that got us through the through card check. We got about the NLRB notified them in June that we had enough for the election. We not only had enough for the election, we had a majority of the workforce on cards, about 56%, and wasn't used going on further than that. When it came time for the period, the employer did want an election, you know, the democracy thing, and that's cool. We agreed to that, and it was going to be 5 weeks away, and we were ready for some terrible things to happen in those 5 weeks. No terrible things happened at all. It turned out that they had chosen to try and have the moral and ethical upper hand throughout this process. So not only wasn't there any intimidation or firings, there also there were no one-on-ones. And when it came time to anti-union group meetings, well, there kind of was, but when our organizer, when she noticed that the moral upper hand was important to him, she convinced him that the mandatory meetings should be one half the owner and the management giving their side, and the second half of the hour should be the union committee talking to the workforce at the mandatory meetings to give our side. It worked extremely well. Thank you, Andrea. And we won by 72%. Then we moved, we stumbled into contract negotiations a couple months later, and they were, you know, very collegial. There were, you know, of course, heated moments of argument and so forth, but they were very collegial. They were very earnest in dealing with us. And this went on for a while, and this ends the 95% of the process that that should and could be used as a template or as a model for future laws, because I can move to 3 years later when we're still in the bargaining process. And we had reached tentative agreement on 89 of 108 sections and 16 articles of the new 16-page contract proposal. The ones that were left were wages, benefits, and union membership. And we decided to move to mediation. Both sides agreed. The mediation sessions over 7 weeks, there were four of them, and it was a very intense 12-hour sessions. And in the middle of this, the company, which had frequent mandatory meetings, they talked about safety, and the owner liked the stage to talk to his employees. They had a mandatory meeting that suddenly surprised us. Yeah, okay. So it suddenly surprised us. They had strong anti-union employees that had never surfaced before get up, and they gave the floor to these people, and the whole meeting was about decertification and lies and, you know, things, innuendos about the unions and the union people running it. And a decertification effort was started at the time of those mandatory meetings. And the NLRB delayed the desert by 6 weeks and had these little posters put around the workplace saying that again that they had, you know, done wrong and that they felt bad about it. And we were deserted after 4 years from the date of the card check was successful and 3.5 years after negotiations started. So obviously a time limit is very important in these matters, as the previous gentleman spoke to.
I was not given the nicest job in the room, but the two of us have to work together to move this along. I'd now like to introduce Marie Spears, who's an SEIU 1199 Northwest lab technician at St. Peter's Hospital in Olympia. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Marie Spears. I'm a medical laboratory technician at St. Peter's Hospital in Olympia. I've been there approximately 4 years. I work in the blood bank. I got most of my training in the blood bank, where I started my training in human and health service fields, was in the Navy, which I went into in July of 1973 during the Vietnam War. I was in the Navy for 11 years, 6 months, and 12 days. Very memorable. Yeah, really. I got out of the Navy in 1985 and came to Washington, and I've loved it here ever since, and I've decided to stay here. Originally, when the union issue came up at our hospital at St. Peter's, I was kind of ambivalent about it, but as my experience unfolded, what caused me to be in more of a favor of a union at St. Peter's Hospital was the hospital's unethical tactics, behaviors, disrespect of myself, my family, and my coworkers. The zeal with which the administration attacked the union astounded me and others. The barrage of anti-union rhetoric, information, misinformation, distortions, you name it. Everything was highly biased against the union, and the information just kept coming. It was overwhelming. Some real facts were represented about unions, but a lot of them were taken out of context and given a negative spin. I personally received over 22 pages of literature. A video was sent to my home, I attended some voluntary meetings. At these meetings, minimal discussion was allowed because it was supposedly to be on a very tight time frame. And so when the time for discussion came up, it was curtailed and they had to go to some other meeting. So when I started, what really got me was when I started to read the administration's literature, I immediately saw red. Having the gift of discernment, I recognized the information for being what it was, lies and misinformation, a lot of it. As a result of St. Pete's very aggressive anti-union campaign, some of the things that happened were two of my laboratory supervisors came and told me that management could talk about union, but staff couldn't. A voluntary meeting that was put on the administration was made mandatory for the histology, pathology, and cytology department, even though many of the employees in that section weren't eligible to vote. The administration told our night shift employees that they'd have to strike if a strike was voted on, even though at that time we hadn't voted for an election and we weren't eligible. And we didn't have a contract. The administration told eligible technical employees they'd lose wages and benefits if they voted for the union. They characterized SEI union organizers as third parties who only wanted our money, for what reasons we don't know, who come in and stir up trouble and walk away afterwards. They told us that our dues money would go to political causes supported by the union with or without our consent. In a memo was implied that the union was in league with the NLRB to exclude or include technical workers. In two memos, the administration stated that if employees signed a union card, they'd automatically become union members without their consent. And there are a lot of more of these that I could tell you, but we're running out of time. As a result of all the different things that happened, a hostile work environment was created as a result of all these things. And it lasted until the union, the SIE contract ratification of 14 November 2003. And since then, things have kind of calmed down a little bit because the union charged the union and eligible employees charged the hospital administration with several violations of employee rights to a fair election. Managers and anti-union co-workers have made snide and rude remarks to myself and others about the union for our support for it. Overall, it's been a very tense and hard time for us. People have been threatened, and our fear of retaliation, fear of losing our jobs, their jobs. Some people have lost their jobs. To sum it up, what I'd like to see is something to be done to prevent these abuses. We need some real legislation that will prevent hospitals from spending patient care dollars to fight unions and to use these kind of tactics against workers. And we need to have more public discussions like we had a couple of weeks ago in Olympia, where we had a public forum where the public could get information about what was going on. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Rebecca Smith, Immigrant Workers Project Coordinator, National Employment Law Project.
Thank you. I work on behalf of immigrant workers, and I want to talk to you about a decision of the United States Supreme Court that has had a devastating impact on immigrant workers around the country, your rights to organize and other labor rights, and also on workplaces where immigrant workers and non-immigrant workers work together. Last year in March of 2002, the Supreme Court had before it a case involving some workers organizing at a factory in California. One of them's name was Jose Castro, and Mr. Castro was fired for organizing a union, and his case went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided that Mr. Castro could not receive back pay, that is, compensation for the time that he lost after he was illegally fired, because he was undocumented and he had used false documents to get a job. The Supreme Court said, even though the employer's violations were what one justice called crude and obvious, if you're undocumented and you've used false documents, it's enough to post that poster that Paul talked about to protect your rights under the NLRA. This case has really had a devastating impact. It's created a firestorm of employers arguing around the country that immigrant workers have no labor rights. Just in the past couple of months, a woman in California who developed ovarian cancer and needed time off from work asked for time off and was fired. And the judge said to her, sorry, you don't get compensation because you're undocumented and you used false documents to get a job. In New York, a landscaper who was owed $1,000 for 10 days' work was told by a judge, sorry, you were undocumented and you used false documents to get a job. I'll give you $5.15 an hour, minimum wage, but nothing more. And in Michigan and in Pennsylvania, courts have decided that even workers' compensation is not completely available to workers who are undocumented because they've used false documents to get a job. Here in Washington State, I had the great honor to get to go on the Immigrant Worker Freedom Ride with a woman named Maria, who worked as a janitor here in Seattle. About a year ago, Maria and six other workers were fired from their jobs because they went on strike. And in June, the NLRB had them reinstated to their jobs because they were illegally fired. Now the employer is claiming that some of them are undocumented, and so they will lose their jobs, perhaps. Employers in Washington State are also starting to claim that workers may not be entitled to all the protections of workers' compensation if they're immigrant workers and they're undocumented. The courts aren't getting it. We have at least 5 million undocumented workers in this country, and we all know what they do. They cook, and they clean, and they drive, and they take care of our kids and our parents, and they build things, and they generally work at the jobs that are the lowest paid and the most dangerous in our society. The courts in the U.S. aren't getting it, but there is a court that has understood how you have a credible labor policy and a credible immigration policy. Shortly after the Supreme Court decided this Hoffman Plastics case, the government of Mexico took the case to a court called the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. And that court is in charge of interpreting human rights law for North America and South America, all countries in that region. And that court decided what we all know, that a worker is a worker is a worker. It does not matter when you come to a country or how you come to a country. Once you have started working, you are entitled to the same rights on the job as any other worker. And the court went on to say, you're entitled to minimum wage, you're entitled to the protection of safety and health laws, and, of course, freedom of association and collective bargaining and back pay if you are illegally fired from your job. What we all need to do now is to say to Congress and have them tell employers that we won't have any more employer hypocrisy. Employers deciding after the fact that a worker, surprise, surprise, might be undocumented and so is therefore not entitled to the protection of any laws. And we need to stop this two-tiered system of justice, just like the Inter-American Court has said. It is a violation of fundamental human rights to say, we will protect you and you and you, but we won't protect you or you or you. Thank you.
Now we have about 5 minutes for the panel to ask clarifying questions of the witnesses, if you would like. I know, Senator Franklin, you had a question earlier. Do you?
Yes, I did. I'm not familiar with the Black Knight.
Who are they? Ahead.
And then I had a second question. Do you think that the lack of knowledge about the role of unions and what they have played in the American workplace, that message is not being heard, so consequently it's impacting what is happening today in regards to the erosion of unions?
I think that first question was for you, Lloyd. What is Black Knight?
What is Black Knight? Black Knight is, we've had a lot of construction companies that are Canadian. They come down, thanks to NAFTA, work in this country, and it's interesting because generally they have Canadians as the management and these immigrants from Mexico and other South American countries as the workers, and they're in here rampantly undercutting our local wages and standards.
And do any of you want to respond to Senator Franklin's second question?
Yes, maybe I can address that. I know at my workplace there's quite a move to keep any information regarding the union out. So for me, to get information, I had to go online, learn about the history of the union in America, learn about the different relevant laws as much as I could. And then I downloaded a lot of information. I shared a lot of information with my fellow coworkers, and I've been encouraging them to gain as much knowledge as they can. I know that when I was in high school, We did have some classes about the history of the unions in America, but I don't see that it's being addressed too much nowadays. But that's what I've been trying to do to get people to get the information. It's just not there. It's not readily accessible to folks.
Representative Conway, you had a question?
My question is about treating the right to join a union as a human right. Becky, I was kind of fascinated by your comment that we could go to an international court and gain protection for a right where we can't in this country. That's kind of also obviously that my issue here simply, we're supposed to ask questions here.
Yeah,
is,
please, Steve. I know you're one I have to watch.
Yeah. But I feel that maybe are we not defending this right as a human right, as opposed to a simple right of law? I mean, Americans get passionate about freedom of speech, freedom of religion. Shouldn't they be equally passionate about freedom of the right to have a union?
Should we give a collective answer?
A little bit rhetorical, Steve. I think that's what we're all here for, right?
Well, freedom to join a union is freedom of speech.
Absolutely.
Mr. Camilla.
Just one quick question. Have you all, and I know we have some different dates of different incidents that you've brought before us, and they're very helpful, have you all seen an increase in anti-union activity, say, from January 20th, 2001 till today?
That's about right.
My opinion is the NLRB process is so screwed up, it's hard to tell, it's hard to tell if it's getting worse because the whole process is so screwed up.
With respect to immigrant workers, I think definitely since Hoffman, we've been keeping very close track, and it was always the fashion for employers to retaliate against immigrant workers, but I think it's been definitely on the rise, and they can do it with impunity now, so it makes it a lot easier.
Any other questions from the panelists? I noticed that not all of you, the two women, didn't provide any written testimony. If particularly, Rebecca, if you could provide us with the names of some of those cases, and perhaps, Marie, you could just write down a few dates and just a few things so that we have it for our notes. That would be really, really useful. Okay. Thank you all. Now, we're going to have an additional 5 minutes of supporting testimony. Is Dr. Baruchka here? Steve Baruchka? Are you here? And while he comes up, why don't we have the worker witnesses for the next session come up to the table? That's Woody, Bud, and Victor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to present my perspective on how organized labor can be the population health doctor for the United States of America. I'll present information that you may not have heard before and you may consider untrue, so I plan to back it up with statements from our federal agencies. Federal bodies such as the Institute of Medicine in its 2003 report, The Future of the Public's Health in the 21st Century, acknowledges that we are less healthy in this than all the other rich countries, and that factors that increase hierarchy in this country are bad for our health. They say on page 20, quote, "For years, the life expectancies of both men and women in the United States have lagged behind those of their counterparts in most other industrialized nations." They go on to write, "In 1998, the United States also ranks 28th in infant mortality among 39 industrialized nations. In the area of chronic disease, reported incidence rates in 1990 for all cancers in males and females were highest in the U.S. among a group of 30 industrialized nations." Further on page 59, they write, "More egalitarian societies, i.e. those with a less steep differential between the richest and the poorest, have better average health because a dollar at the bottom buys more health than a dollar at the top," end of quote. In other words, experts in the federal government very clearly recognize that in the United States of America, the richest and most powerful country in world history, the country that spends half of the world's health care bill, is less healthy than all the other rich countries. And they admit it's the gap between the rich and the poor that is mostly responsible for that. They know that. But one would think that they don't want you to know that. And I think that there's very little effort by journalists or the media to bring this to the attention of the American public. Just as journalists in our media were embedded among the demonstrators wearing police uniforms at the Miami Free Trade of the America meeting last month, today the media know better than to tell the American people that they pay the ultimate price for having this country run the way it does, namely, we all die younger than we should. Instead, they extol the virtues of cutting taxes for the rich and giving handouts to corporations. They could write the facts and point out that we are unhealthy and the big gap in our society is responsible for this, just as the Institute of Medicine's report points out. Even our own Public Health Seattle King County Health Department also admits this, for example, in their Communities Count 2000 report, where they write that we should be narrowing the income gap. Now, consider this far-fetched analogy. After the Surgeon General's report in 1964 linked smoking with poor health, we had warning labels on cigarette packages. If we did something similar based on the recent Institute of Medicine report, we might have a warning on the paychecks of workers along the lines of, your low pay is dangerous for your health and the health of the rich, so you'd best organize or die. The point I want to make to the panel is that if labor is not allowed to organize, it'll be bad for all of our health. The reason is that nothing determines the health of a country more than some measure of the gap between the rich and the poor, and union strength helps to reduce that gap. Once basic needs are satisfied and everyone has enough to eat, a roof over their heads, and clean water to drink, it's the gap that matters most. If there's a big gap, our health will be worse, while a smaller gap translates into better health. Studies have shown that this factor, the gap between the rich and the poor, is more important than behaviors such as diet, exercise, smoking, and seeing your doctor. And we understand the biological reasons why being lower down in the ranking in society is bad for our health. Those lower down have to ride the shame train. They have to stand in line at the food banks. They have to beg for assistance from the government. We don't even educate children for free anymore, as Seattle's Pay for K program to try and extract money from the parents of kindergarten children demonstrates. So the gap makes us all sick, not just those struggling with very low incomes. When you're lower down, you suffer more from chronic stress. This elevates your blood pressure, your glucose control is poor, and so you're more apt to have diabetes, and we're seeing adult onset diabetes in younger and younger children. Also, you have more plaque deposition in coronary arteries, and you're more likely to die of a heart attack. Being low down also depresses your immune surveillance and makes you more likely to get a cancer. So relative poverty is the biggest risk factor for poor health. Now, labor unions can bring this message to the workers and get them to work together to fight not only for a livable wage, but to bring down the maximum wage. Now, other notable figures say these ideas, too. President Jimmy Carter, who won the 2002 Nobel Peace Prize, in his acceptance speech said, quote, I was asked to discuss here in Oslo the greatest challenge that the world faces. I decided that the most serious and universal problem is the growing chasm between the richest and poorest people on Earth. The results of this disparity are root causes of most of the world's unresolved problems, including starvation, illiteracy, environmental degradation, violent conflict, and unnecessary illnesses that range from guinea worm to AIDS. 55 years ago, when membership in labor unions was at an all-time high in this country, we were one of the five healthiest countries in the world. At that time, it was the poorest fifth in America that saw the biggest percentage in income gain, and our gap between the rich and the poor was much smaller then. Since then, our health relative to other countries has declined at about the same pace as the decline in union membership. So that today there are 25 countries that are healthier than we are, and perhaps you can look at a graph of back when there were only 24 countries that were healthier than we are. We've now slipped a bit further, and you can imagine the reason why. Well, so labor union membership rates among countries are related to the health of those countries. Why? What do labor unions do? They fight for decent wages and lift the bottom up. Within the United States today, labor unions are strongest in the Midwest, where our health as a population is the best, and they're weakest in the Southeast, where our health is the worst. So everything fits together very nicely. So why might labor union membership rates be related to the health of the whole country? Just ask what collective bargaining does. Does it get better pay for the CEOs? No. Collective bargaining increases pay and benefits for lower categories of workers. Nurses, steam fitters, teachers, and bus drivers. These are the people that do the critical work that's required in this country. Now, the trend in this country, as you've heard, is to pay these kind of people less and less, and without collective bargaining rights, it's easier and easier to do that. Well, that happens, and yet we continue to pay our CEOs stratospheric compensations, and the gap in the, between the rich and the poor rises dramatically. The minimum wage in Washington State is just a little over $7 an hour. The maximum wage in the United States is about $150,000 an hour. Now, the maximum wage went up over last year $10,000 an hour. That was the increase in the maximum wage. While that CEO's company stock dropped 67%. So, in this country, there's no shame for being paid such outrageous amounts. The average CEO in America makes more in one day than most workers make in a year. But for somehow, the poor believe that this is good, that giving the top obscene compensation is somehow worth it, these people are worth every penny we pay for them. Look at the trend among CEO entry-level worker pay gaps in this country. In 1980, the gap between the CEO and the entry level was 40 to 1. By 1999, it had grown to 476 to 1, and in 2001, for the Fortune 100 companies, it's over 1,000 to 1. Now, in the healthiest country in the world, Japan, it's 11 to 1. If we go 125 miles north to Canada, it's 20 to 1. So, and Canada, of course, is much healthier than we are. So I want you to think that because we don't have collective bargaining in this country, because we don't have labor union strength, we all die much younger than we need to. Now, those of us in the bottom, the basic feeling is that we're not worth much anyway, and we get what we deserve. And that's the key value in the United States that we must fight, because the poor think that a big gap is good for them because someday they'll strike it rich and they'll be on top and they want it all. Now, when I speak about the poor, I don't just mean the homeless, who are obviously not even getting basic needs met. I speak of you and me, people who are outside the top 10% of wealth in this country, people who work at low-wage jobs, people who work at two or three jobs just to make ends meet and have no security or benefits. So the working class, you and I with modest incomes, we may not be in abject poverty, but most of us feel poor compared to the lifestyles of the rich and famous that we see paraded before us all the time. So, I just want to point out that we are so far behind the healthiest countries that even if we did something drastic and won the war on heart disease, so where there were no more deaths from heart disease will kill about half of us in this room here. Suppose we had no more deaths from heart disease, we still wouldn't be the healthiest country in the world. So I would suggest 55 years ago, when unions were strong, we were one of the healthiest countries in the world, and now, even if we cured heart disease, we still wouldn't be. So the people that are lower down want us to believe that if they sponsor more medical programs that are veiled as profit care, that it'll be good for you. But the new Medicare legislation passed last week won't buy us any health. It will just end up with profits. So in your deliberations, I want you to recognize that the right to that if you diminish the right to organize, that decision will kill far more people than were killed during the Holocaust and the Second World War. So income inequality in the United States is not a sign that freedom of opportunity is working. As the income gap persists and grows, unless you believe that a few people are naturally born to ride stallions while most of us are born to be saddled, that is not freedom of opportunity. So what I want you to do is we have to throw off those saddles and chase after the riders and put them in their place. There aren't that many riders, you know. We vastly outnumber the riders, and unions are the steed that we need to do that. They're our hope for population health doctors that America needs. So organized labor is our population health doctor, and we should make their task to heal our society as easy as possible. Thank you.